support comes from Bethel Dental Care, providing general dentistry from pediatrics to geriatrics in a comfortable atmosphere. A proud supporter and promoter of WOSU programming. More information at 614-451-0341 or online at betheldentalcare.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is Wellness Wednesday. And I hate to break it to you, but your taste buds are big, fat, well, little tiny liars, perhaps. A recent Cornell study found that people equate organic food with foods low in calories and high in fiber, regardless of how they taste. Here to tell us why this happens and why many of us think it's okay to eat a whole bag of free-range pork rinds is Lindsay Abrams of The Atlantic. Lindsay is an editorial fellow for The Atlantic Health Channel. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So you say that this study was conducted in a shopping mall.
It was, right in the middle of a shopping mall food court.
Oh, and a food court, no less. Okay.
Yeah. And basically what Cornell researchers wanted to figure out is, what does the word organic actually mean to people when they're shopping and they see it on labels? What are the associations they're making and why are they buying that food? And what they found is that people aren't necessarily thinking about organic food just in terms of it not having pesticides or being grown in sustainable ways, but they have all these other associations with health that might not be entirely accurate.
Well, so what is organic, just for the record, then?
So basically, organic food is food that is grown sustainably. They doesn't use pesticides, but it doesn't actually have any additional nutritional content. It wouldn't necessarily taste different, at least not in a way that you can identify as, oh, this is organic and something else isn't. So what the researchers did is they told people they were participating in a taste test, and they would give them cookies, potato chips, and yogurt. Some of the food was labeled organic. Some of it wasn't. In reality, it was all organic food. And they asked the people to talk about how the food tasted, how healthy it tasted, and how many calories they thought it might have.
And what you mentioned a term, health halo. It sounds nice, but it's the whole idea is it's deceptive.
Exactly. So when the people tasted the food that was called organic, they thought it tasted like it had fewer calories than the regular food. They thought it tasted high in fiber. And so they got this idea that because it was called organic, it was healthier. And I'm not sure how you taste something as having fewer calories, but this was definitely an effect that they were having.
And did people who consider themselves really astute consumers, were they fooled as well?
There was a slightly diminished effect for people who are used to reading labels, who always buy organic or do it often, so they kind of know what they're doing and what the marketing tactic is. But what this shows is that people who are just kind of walking down the aisle of the supermarket and see things with the big green label on it might think, oh, this is a better purchase, for reasons that don't really make sense.
Oh, the colors are interesting, too. I know that wasn't necessarily part of the study, but just the colors they used to, signify health and organic and all of that.
Right, and there have been other studies that have shown that when people see a green label on food, they assume it's healthier, regardless of what it actually says.
So they should be reading the labels and not judging it by the words they use in the packaging or the colors they use or what they say.
Absolutely.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Lindsay Abrams. She's an editorial fellow for the Atlantic Health Channel, and she writes about studies. If you have a question or comment for her on any of these topics, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You also have written recently about research that studies the sounds or how listening to certain sounds can aid you in sleep. What sent researchers in that direction in the first place?
This one was fascinating to me because there has been some research, and it's not quite mainstream, but this idea that a way to help people sleep and sleep better at night is to apply an electrical current to their brain, which has shown some results in labs, but I don't know about you. The thought of going to sleep with electrodes applied to my head doesn't sound very relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what German researchers tried to do is find perhaps a safer, more acceptable way of doing this, and they used sound instead of electricity. And so pretty much people came and slept in a sleep lab, and while they were sleeping, they played something called pink noise, which is a kind of neutral sound that they synchronized to the people's brain rhythm. So while the people were in their deep sleep, the sound would come and kind of amplify their brain waves. So they weren't necessarily sleeping longer, but they seemed to be sleeping more deeply.
Now, this means what you're saying is they would custom amplify them.
Yes, it would be sound that was specifically synchronized to what was happening in these people's brains. It would kind of be an amplification method.
And it was just sound.
It was just sound. So no electricity, no electrodes, just sound being piped into the room. And they could actually see this happening on the brain monitors, that the sound was causing something to happen in their brain. And they were also able to test it, because during this deep sleep period is when a lot of memory retention happens. So before the participants went to bed, they would be shown pairs of words. And in the mornings, they would be tested. And on the night when the sound was played, they remembered a lot more of the pairs, which, when associated with the increased brain waves that they saw, suggested that they were indeed sleeping deeply.
And when you get a good rest, you're fresher and you can remember things better.
Exactly.
Did they reflect at all on kind of that trend? I don't know how big it still is, but sort of that ambient sound thing where, you know, you go to sleep with, you know, a CD in or something, you know, from your iPod or your phone with, you know, waves breaking against the shore or thunderstorms and all that kind of thing?
You know, they didn't talk too much about that, but it wouldn't seem like this study would really support those methods working, because you needed those sounds that were really in sync and personalized to your brain. But if they were to develop this research, perhaps there could be a way for them to kind of market music in that way that was monitoring your brain and working at the same time.
They mentioned some of the implications, or you did in your article, that it's been proposed as a way of, or electric brain stimulation has been proposed as a way of treating Alzheimer's, fighting depression, easing pain, and boosting creativity. All of those things have implications. Of course, we know that they're doing things with the brain, amazing things, every single day now.
Right. All of that is kind of out there right now. But if you could use electric brain stimulation for all of those things, it would seem that there would be no reason why you couldn't use sound also. If it works while people are sleeping, maybe it could be used while they're awake and help enhance their brain activity in those situations.
It makes me kind of wonder, too, about people who are hard of hearing or don't hear. I mean, maybe electric brain stimulation could help them in ways that, you know, hearing people don't need.
For them, they would definitely need the electrodes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You have all, speaking of sound and brain, you recently wrote about the way the brain reacts to music. And how was that study conducted? What were they going for?
This one, it has less practical implications than the other one, I think, but it has some pretty cool findings. Basically, at Stanford University, they took people who don't have much music training, and they played them some classical music that they probably haven't heard before, and then watched what was happening in their brains through fMRI machines while they were listening to it. And what they found was pretty cool is that all these people came in to listen to the music. They're different people. They bring in different associations, different backgrounds. But their brain activity looked remarkably similar while the music was playing. And they would also play them the music with the rhythm removed, so it kind of sounded like a harmonized hissing, or they would play it in a way that was atonal so that it wasn't quite music anymore. And in both of those situations, everyone's brain looked different. They were pretty much just processing sound.
Huh.
But it seemed that something special was going on when the real music was playing.
You know, I was listening to a story yesterday on NPR about whether, you know, musical education and the importance of artistic education and so forth. And there's always that debate out there and no particular studies that prove that it helps. But and nothing that shows that it improves people's scores, you know, and their testing and so forth. But a person, an expert that was consulted for the story did say, it depends on how you test them. The way we're testing them is may not be reflective of whatever they're getting out of that kind of an education.
Exactly. And I think what this really shows is that more of music having just a personal benefit to people is that it really shows how music has this collective appeal and how when, you know, people can be brought together by it.
Yeah.
And they're saying that maybe because their brains were so similar is showing why music has that social capacity.
Interesting why we all leave a concert in pretty much a good mood.
Perhaps, yes. Or why we can all agree, even if we have different preferences, that there is something worth listening to going on.
One more real quick before we have to let you go. I've heard about this before. Google searches reveal lots of patterns. What you wrote about was what it reveals about mental health patterns.
Right. That one was great. They looked at it's really hard to track what's going on with mental illness. People are less likely to report it. It's something that can be very complex. They might not realize they're suffering from a mental illness. They might not want to tell someone who calls doing a television survey, oh, yes, I have OCD or something like that. So what these researchers did is they looked at people who were Googling information, either for themselves or a friend, symptoms, medications, that kind of thing, and they were able to track seasonal patterns in mental illness, which they weren't sure before existed. But they did show that during the summer, a whole host of diseases seemed to be dropping. Schizophrenia, bipolar, ADHD, anxiety, all of these things seemed to be occurring less in the summer.
Did they break it out by age or any other demographics?
Unfortunately, you're only really able to get the big picture with Google Trends. They weren't able to see who specifically was looking. And, of course, they weren't able to see whether people had actual diagnosable cases of any of these disorders.
So what...
But it can give us a big picture.
And it... Okay, so it gives us a big picture. People aren't worrying about those things as much. They're not curious about them during certain times of the year.
That's what it seems like. And that could correspond to perhaps people not experiencing the symptoms during those times of the year. Because it was so consistent and because they were such big trends, they think there's reason to believe that this is representing, to some degree, actual occurrences of these illnesses.
School's out, you know. It sounds like when school's out, people are happier.
Yes. Well, 7% less anxiety.
Yeah, exactly. That's significant in this country. Lindsay Abrams, editorial fellow for the Atlantic Health Channel, thanks so much for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Coming up, we're going to continue with our Wellness Wednesday. Topic coming up is going to be about serious illness and when it strikes, but how part of the problem might be where you are trying to get better, the hospital. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thanks for joining us today for All Sides with Ann Fisher. 57 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers are likely with pop-up thunderstorms possible. We'll reach a high near 70. There's still a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 61. Expect some sunshine on Thursday and warmer temperatures, a high of 82. Support comes from Meijer, dedicated to fighting against hunger with the Simply Give food pantry program. In addition to customer donations, Meijer will give $1 million to distribute among the many food pantries in our communities this year. Information is available in-store or at Meijer.com. And the Council for Older Adults of Delaware County can help reduce the stress of caring for older relatives by providing tools and support needed to keep loved ones living safely and independently at home. More information is available by calling 740-363-6677 or online at growingolder.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Lots of people have a fear of hospitals, but when serious illness strikes, they are the first place most of us turn. We don't have a choice. Unfortunately, sometimes hospitals can become breeding grounds for bacteria that can cause deadly infections. Joining us now to discuss what hospitals can do to combat this problem is Dr. Curtis Donsky. He's the chair of the Infection Control Committee at the Lewis Stokes VA Medical Center and lead author on a new paper about hospital disinfection. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What spurred this paper, what spurred your study of this in the first place?
Well, I think there has been increasing appreciation of the role of the environment in transmission of infections in the past several years. There's now an appreciation, for example, that healthcare workers who touch environmental surfaces, if you touch a bed rail or a bedside table in a patient room, you can contaminate your hands as easily as if you touch the patient. And being admitted to a room where a person previously had an infection can increase the risk to the subsequent patient admitted to that room. So there's one of the issues is just simply the rising awareness of how important the environment can be as a risk for infection. And then the second part that really spurred this particular study is a particular pathogen called C. diff or C. difficile. And this pathogen is particularly a problem for the environment because it forms spores that are resistant to being killed by the usual disinfectants we use in the hospital. So it can last for basically years on surfaces. And it's been a particular challenge for us in hospitals in dealing with infections. So we got started because we were having, like many places around the country, a problem with C. diff infections.
Is C. diff new?
No, C. diff has been around. It was discovered around early 1980s, and the rates of infection remained relatively stable up until around 2000. And then at that point, we really had an explosion of C. diff. The rate has tripled in the past decade, beginning around 2000, and that's happened here as well as in Europe and in Canada. And that's been associated with the emergence of a new strain of C. diff, which seems to be tougher to deal with and more able to spread in hospitals.
And when C. diff was discovered, the resistant spores was discovered as well at the same time. They knew that it was a tough one.
They knew it was a tough one, and in hospitals, we typically use products that, for most cleaning, that do not kill the spore form of the organism. The product that is effective is bleach, is the common product that we use is effective. And, many hospitals use bleach only for C. difficile rooms. So we've had an effective product for many years, but it's continued to be a problem. We have, despite that product, we know there's an ongoing problem with transmission of C. diff.
And now it's changing, and there's a new form, and because of that, it's likely it could change again.
Yes, that is actually, there seem to be, as new strains are introduced into hospitals or into our kind of healthcare system, with this new strain, it had some additional resistance to antibiotics, for example, which it's resistant to many of the antibiotics that are used in the hospital, which allowed it to spread because we have so many patients in the hospital who are receiving antibiotics. And at this point, it really can spread despite patients being on antibiotics that in the past might have prevented it from growing.
So ultimately, then, it's easier to prevent it than to treat it at this point.
We have an effective treatment. We have some effective treatments for C. diff, but one of the major problems is that this is an infection that tends to come back. So about 25% of patients who develop a C. diff infection will develop a recurrence, and some of them go on to develop multiple recurrences.
And what's a C. diff infection like? What do we mean by that? I'm trying to, is it something that, how does it manifest?
So C. diff is the major cause of diarrheal illness in the hospital setting. So the spores are ingested, they germinate in the intestinal tract, they grow and produce toxins that result in diarrhea primarily.
Are these kinds of problems first world problems? Are they something that aren't necessarily a problem in developing countries, more so in places like the United States?
It is much more common as a problem in the United States and in developed areas. So Europe and Canada and the United States have particularly been having problems with this new strain of C. diff. One of the in the developing world, however, we have less testing being done, so we really don't know. There could be some of this, more of this problem there than we realize because we're not testing for it.
Yeah, it's just not being teased out at this point. There's so much.
Yes.
Going on. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. My guest is Dr. Curtis Donsky. He's chair of the Infection Control Committee at the Lewis Stokes VA Medical Center. And we're talking about a new paper he's lead author on about hospital disinfection and specifically the bacteria C. diff. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Donsky, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So it can be treated, but once again, prevention is key.
Yes, that is correct. We have in prevention in the hospital setting, when patients develop an infection due to C. diff, we put them in isolation into a room where the healthcare workers will wear gowns and gloves when they go in and contact the patient. And the other major part of infection control involves cleaning the environment because, again, through diarrhea, these patients develop contamination. We can detect C. diff on all over their room, as well as being on the patient themselves. And so cleaning is essential. And we try to do both cleaning on a daily basis and with bleach wipes, and then also when the patient is discharged.
Dumb question for the day. If C. diff is so easy to catch and it's such a big problem in hospitals, why isn't it an even bigger problem out in the general public?
So hospitals are the primary setting because we have sick patients who are spreading the organism, and we have a lot of susceptible patients. So patients in the hospital are often taking broad-spectrum antibiotics that eliminate the normal bacteria in their colon that might protect them. So there are a lot of patients who are getting antibiotics in the outpatient setting, but they're less likely to be exposed to C. diff. We have the perfect combination of susceptible patients on antibiotics and exposure. And so the hospitals and nursing homes actually are the major place where we see these infections.
Okay, that kind of goes to your question. Melissa in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for this discussion. 2 years ago, my mother passed away, and for about 3 months before she passed away, she had C. diff. And I'm not sure if it came from the nursing home or the hospital because she was in and out probably 4 or 5 times of both places before she passed away. And I guess I wonder if you can speak to nursing homes. I know you're focusing on hospitals, but exactly what you're saying is what the doctors told me because she was on and off antibiotics for quite a while. So what you just mentioned, you know, rings true with what the doctors were telling me at the time.
Sure. We see a lot of patients in our hospital and long-term care facility, and it's often exactly as you described. It's very difficult to sort out where the C. diff was picked up. The only way to really know for sure is to do some molecular testing and typing to see where the organism was picked up and to do cultures as well. We're actually participating now in a study with the CDC where we're culturing all of our patients in our long-term care facility to try to sort out where the bug is actually being picked up. So we see it in both places. Some patients receive antibiotics in the hospital, and then they pick the organism up in long-term care, and it occurs the opposite way as well. Patients from long-term care take the organism back with them to the hospital.
Melissa, sorry for your loss, and thank you for that question. When someone like Melissa's mother is carrying around the organism, it's a known quantity. What happens when she's back and forth between the hospital and the nursing home? Is this something that hospitals need to know, and do they know, and do they prepare for a patient like that?
So patients who have, and what she describes is her mother having C. diff for 3 months. And so the typical treatment course for C. diff is about 10 to 14 days. And so someone who experienced C. diff for 3 months would have been a person who developed a recurrence. So unfortunately, she was one of those individuals who developed a recurrence and could not really clear the organism. We typically now keep patients with C. diff in isolation while they're having diarrhea or while they're being treated. So once the diarrhea resolves, many hospitals or nursing homes would take a person out of isolation, and they potentially at that point will be less likely to spread the organism, but the risk is not zero. So hospitals or nursing homes will know if someone's coming in with an acute infection they're still being treated for, mm-hmm. but they may not know that they had an infection, 2 weeks ago, for example, that's resolved. And this is one of our problems with transmission. There are patients who are coming back and forth with these organisms, and we don't know.
And I would imagine that's very, particularly with nursing home patients. I mean, they're in and out all the time. Some of them.
Yes, we've had patients we've documented going back and forth 6-10 times mm-hmm. within the course of a few months, and it's very common.
Jackie in Pataskala, you're on the air with Dr. Curtis Donsky. Welcome, Jackie.
Hi, I just had a comment. I just got in my car a few minutes ago, turned the radio on, and heard C. diff mentioned. And I had an experience with this about 5 or 6 years ago, thinking that I had some kind of intestinal flu. And my personal policy is to try to tough these things out for a week or so before I run to the doctor.
Wow.
It got worse before it got better, so I took myself to the doctor, and he seemed to think that I did have some kind of intestinal flu, and to give it a few more days to right itself. I waited another 2 weeks, and by that time I'd lost quite a bit of weight, and the only thing I could really keep down was water, which I guess they told me was a really good thing, because apparently, of course, with the diarrhea, a lot of people become dangerously dehydrated. But my comment was that apparently this occurred because I'd had a root canal, and the final diagnosis was that the antibiotic I was put on following the root canal killed out all the bacteria, the good and the bad, opening me up to this, to being susceptible to getting the C. diff. I always kind of appreciated that name, because I think difficile or diff, it is a difficult thing to get rid of. And sure enough, I finally did get put on medication, and it seemed to correct itself, and was out of town, and all the symptoms started again, and I think this is back, and it was. And so they tried something different the second time, and fortunately that seemed to fix everything. But it was a very strange thing to have. I'd never had anything like it before, and it was kind of scary after going on for so long. But I appreciate all your comments.
You have an incredible threshold for suffering, Jackie.
Well, I just thought, if nothing else comes out of this, I've lost a few pounds. But I wouldn't wish that on anybody,
wow.
because it was just a very not a pleasant thing. And ironically, I talked to several people later and mentioned this, and they had experiences with it. One lady had such a hard time with it, she ended up in the hospital and had to have surgery on her intestines and ended up with one of those. I can't think of the medical name. The bags, and I thought, oh my gosh, I couldn't imagine it going that far, but apparently it has. So, anyway, I just thought I'd share that. It's an interesting program, and it's something that, if I hadn't been involved with it myself, would have been totally unfamiliar. So hopefully this will introduce a lot of other people to it. So if they have symptoms, they don't put it off for so long like I did. So.
Well, thank you, Jackie.
Thank you. Bye.
Dr. Donsky, the protocol to prevent the spread of this, what you're describing in the paper and so forth, is this pretty rigorous? I mean, are hospitals glomming onto this? Is this something they're going to start doing? Or is it difficult to achieve that kind of protocol?
So I would just first comment on the caller. Okay. Caller's comment quickly to say that her story is actually fairly common. Mm-hmm. We do see some patients in the outpatient setting who get C. diff, and we see healthcare workers occasionally who get C. diff as well. And this is the very common story. Dental procedures, they give antibiotics that eliminate the normal flora and C. diff. We've had a number of doctors and nurses who've had C. diff with that story. With regard to the environmental cleaning situation, I think we call our environmental cleaning intervention kind of an odyssey because there were so many kind of twists and turns in getting a good system in place. But I think that what we tried to bring out in the article is that this is actually all very feasible. We were not asking people to do much more than their usual job. And that's one of the points we tried to make, that this can be achieved with standard cleaning, with bleach. It's just applying it correctly and monitoring and making sure that things are being done. Things that we did that were effective, we had a dedicated team of cleaners. So we had our most motivated cleaners to get in, so we weren't dealing with people who might be less motivated or new to the position. Mm-hmm. And we had a system in place whereby we required someone to clear the room after patients were discharged, so to make sure that someone signed their name saying this room is cleared for the next patient to enter, really putting extra pressure on our environmental services people to really do a good job.
You know, it's kind of an interesting whole topic about people who are willing to put themselves out there like that and do a job like that, that kind of cleanup job.
Yeah, I just say that our folks have been really outstanding in terms of what they've done. I really have to give them the credit. They're really doing the work. And what we've really done is shown that what we've done is had effective ways to monitor cleaning. And this is a real lack for many hospitals around the country. We do not have effective methods to assess how good cleaning is being done in the hospital. And we were in a research setting where we were able to do this with cultures, but many hospitals are really in the dark in a way in terms of how they assess their cleaning practices.
Okay, so it's not the cleaning practice, it's the assessment to make sure you've gotten everything.
Yes, and that's what's lacking for many hospitals.
All right. Well, Dr. Curtis Donsky, thanks so much for talking with us about it. I have a feeling it's an ongoing conversation, though, so thanks for your help today.
Sure, you're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Curtis Donsky, he's chair of the Infection Control Committee at the Lewis Stokes VA Medical Center. Coming up, we're going to be looking into some research on exercise physiology. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the hell of American daycare. We talk with Jonathan Cohn about his cover story in the New Republic. 40% of children under 5 are in daycare, but he writes that the overall quality of daycare is wildly uneven and barely monitored, and at the lower end, it's Dickensian. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And you are running out of time to support our station and register to win an iPad Mini. No pledge is necessary and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org, but get your entry in before the start of the drive. And support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, partnering with the STAR program of the Wexner Medical Center to present An Unforgettable Evening with Natalie Cole, April 25th in the Mershon Auditorium. This fundraiser features the Grammy Award winner's take on the Great American Songbook. Tickets and VIP packages at wexarts.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The conventional wisdom in the workout world is that if you want those rock-hard six-pack abs, you have to hit the floor and do some sit-ups. Tight abs might be pleasing to the eye, but there is some disagreement about whether they actually make us healthier. Joining us now to discuss if we should really be working towards that six-pack is Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the phys ed column for the New York Times and is author of the book, The First 20 Minutes. A new ebook companion to that book was just released. It's called The First 20 Minutes Personal Trainer, The Right and the Wrong Workouts for Everyone. Welcome back to the show, Gretchen.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about those six packs? I'm not even shooting for, I'm just a house of cards at this point, but some people still are shooting for those six pack abs. What do we mean that there's disagreement?
Well, six-pack abs are very attractive if you're young and have them and wear no shirt, which is fine if your goal from your workout is to impress your girlfriend or boyfriend, then six-pack abs may have utility. If your goal is to have a healthy back and also to have a good healthy core, then doing sit-ups is almost certainly counterproductive.
What do we mean by sit-ups? I don't even remember the last time someone said, we're going to do sit-ups. It's always crunches or something like that.
Well, a lot of people actually think they're doing crunches and are probably doing something that is closer to a sit-up. A good crunch, one that is healthy for your back, basically involves lying on the ground with your knees bent, preferably with your hands under your lower back to protect your lower back, lifting your head and your shoulders in one unit and only lifting them a few inches off the ground. You do not roll up to your knees. You don't pull yourself all the way up. You basically just lift your shoulders up off the ground. If you do much more than that, there's very good evidence that you can actually hurt your lower back pretty easily.
And maybe not know it right away.
There was a really interesting study that some scientists did with spines from a pig, and they actually bent them over and over and over using a particular machine. And they found that the more times you bent them, at some point they essentially broke. You began to get damage. So there may be a limited number of times that you can bend your spine over the course of your life. That's a lot. We can do it a lot of times. But if you're doing 500 sit-ups, which some people do in order to get a six-pack ab, you may actually be damaging your spine.
Now, you talked about core, that what's more important is the core, and that doesn't necessarily have to, working out for that doesn't necessarily involve anything close to a sit-up.
No, and in fact, the people who develop these six-pack abs, they're very aesthetically pleasing, but they're not actually working or strengthening the muscles that are most important in terms of protecting your spine and giving you what's known as functional fitness. That means the ability to do the things in your life that you want to do. Pick up your laundry safely, open a car door. All those things actually do involve the core.
Right.
But what they really involve is making sure that all of the muscles around your lower back, that all of those are strong enough for you to do what you need to do, that none are more strong than others, which actually pulls your spine out of alignment. What you want is a stable core, and you can achieve that with just a few really simple exercises.
Like what?
What's generally advised from people who really study this carefully, and a lot of personal trainers have a lot of opinions, but the best scientific advice is that you do some crunches, and you do them as I described before, maybe do 20. Do an exercise that's known as the bird dog, which is exactly what it sounds like. You get on all fours, you lift one arm and the opposing leg as if you were pointing at something if you're a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Hold that for 15, 20 seconds, switch legs. That works the muscles actually in your lower back. Then do some side planks where you lie on the ground, lift yourself up off the ground. That works the muscles along the side of your spine. All you need to do is get those strong enough for you to do what your body needs to do. They don't need to be super strong. They don't need to be super attractive. They just need to keep your spine straight and allow you to have enough functional fitness.
It's funny because I think about probably some of the best looking fitness I was in my 20s was when I threw my back out for the first time running the vacuum cleaner.
It's funny. I've spoken with back experts who say things like that they have people with absolutely beautiful six-pack abs who sneeze and throw their backs out.
Yep. Ooh,
because
God.
They do not have a good stable core.
What about the use of the, the half discs? I can't think of the name of them, but they're, balancing kinds of exercises?
Oh, they're wonderful, particularly for those of us who are no longer 20, because your sense of balance does degrade with age, and probably all of us who are past the age of 40 know that. So, yes, I actually have one of those discs and stand on it. And it does also use some of the muscles in your back, so it builds some of the muscles in your core. But even more importantly, it does actually improve your sense of balance. And if you don't fall, you're much less likely to hurt yourself.
I was checking out the first 20 minutes personal trainer. I have the hard manuscript of your new ebook, and it starts out with myth information, which I always love, but this is a big one lately. The number one myth, you should always stretch before exercising. That's really coming into play a lot now, I've noticed.
It's an extremely emotional issue.
Yes.
For a lot of people. I just wrote a column about a new review that had come out that gathered information about more than 100 earlier studies of static stretching before you work out. And static stretching is what most of us think of as stretching, which is bending over or isolating one muscle and holding that pose for 30 seconds or so, reaching for your toes or leaning against a wall to stretch your hamstrings. And there's very persuasive evidence that actually does make muscles weaker, and it makes you less ready for an upcoming exercise. It's a very counterproductive way to warm up for exercise.
Versus running across, doing a quick jog across a room, or
what they call a dynamic warm-up.
Okay. Okay.
Which means you move. You try and move the muscles. You essentially stretch the muscles, but you stretch them by moving them. And I should make it really clear that when I write about the science of stretching and how it's counterproductive before exercise, that doesn't mean never stretch. If you like stretching, in fact, if you like stretching before exercise, it probably is fine, unless you're competing for an Olympic medal. It's not going to decrease your performance that much. If you like it, keep doing it. If you've never stretched, don't worry about it. You're probably not missing much. If you're getting older, stretching at some point during the day is probably a good idea, just to keep the range of motion in your joints, to keep them as flexible as they can be.
One of my boot camp, you know, teachers, she does a more of a static stretch at the end of the hour.
And, you know, there's evidence that that might be the time to do it. They did one study in which they had people stretch before or after exercise and see which one seemed to make muscles less painful the next day. Stretching afterwards was more effective than stretching beforehand in terms of reducing muscle soreness, but it reduced the soreness by about a 1 on a 1 to 100 scale. So it's still a pretty slight advantage. But for a lot of people, if you do want to stretch, it's the best time because you're dressed for it. You're ready for it. You do it. That's not a minor consideration. If you're going to stretch, it's probably the best time.
My guest, once again, Gretchen Reynolds, columnist for the New York Times Well blog. We are talking about myths, exercise myths. Give us a call if you have a question or comment about your exercise regimen or about something we're talking about, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Carol in New Middletown, you're on the air. Welcome, Carol.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Can I just start talking?
Sure.
Okay. I just tuned in, and unfortunately, I missed a lot. But what I wanted to ask is she familiar with the McKenzie therapy? There's a book called Treat Your Own Back by Robin McKenzie. I found out about this at least about 15 years ago when my back went out and I went to the Cleveland Clinic. And this, it's a very small book, but the extension stretches and exercises in it have helped me tremendously. And throughout the years, I'm able to immediately, if I start to feel my back going, do these. And it really, you know, if you follow this book, if you follow what it tells you to do and not to do, my family uses it. I've given it to a friend recently, a new friend that I met, who's gone to chiropractors mm-hmm. for 10 years. And she didn't read it. She kept putting it aside. I sent it to her. And finally, she picked up and read it, and she said she's amazed how much the two exercises have helped her back. So anyway.
Gretchen, have you heard about that? I'm sorry.
I have to admit I'm not familiar with that particular protocol, but the Cleveland Clinic certainly is very reputable. So if they recommended it, I think that's, it undoubtedly has benefits.
Okay. And just the name of the book is Treat Your Own Back. Carol, thanks for that call. We have an email from Frank. He writes, one of the most important muscles in the body is the psoas, P-S-O-A-S, P-S-O-A-S, yeah. It connects the hips and spine coming through the core of the body. It is responsible for stability and support. It ties into many issues related to knees, hips, backs, etc. This is the big core muscle.
Well, it's one of them.
Okay.
And it is very important, especially as you get older. It tends to be one that gives people problems because it is in the hip, and a lot of people, especially runners, will start reporting that they have hip and knee problems that they never had when they were younger. And there is some evidence that doing strength training that targets the hip is very important and maybe more important than stretching, although that's hard to know. It's probably a good idea if you have tight hips or if you have hip pain to see a physical therapist and ask them help you set up a regimen of exercises and stretches that really target the hip flexors and the muscles and tendons around the hip joint. Because that does, it's interesting, a lot of people who have runner's knee, they actually find that the big problem is that they have really high or tight hips.
Before we move on, one of the suggestions that you give is jumping jacks.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Skipping forward and backward for about a minute, the high leg marches, that sort of thing?
For warming up, yes, they are actually excellent. And that's because what those sorts of movements do is they do two things. The first is they literally warm up the tissues that you're likely to be using in your subsequent exercise. You actually want those tissues to be warm. You want the temperature to be higher. Then they are more supple. They're less likely to be hurt. And as they're warming up, you do increase the range of motion in all of the joints that you're moving. So if you're doing jumping jacks, you are increasing, hopefully, you're increasing the range of motion in your hips, in your back, in your shoulders. So if you're going to be playing tennis, it's really important that you warm up and increase the range of motion in all of those joints. Whereas if you just sit on the ground and reach for your toes and hold that position, that seems to actually reduce the range of motion in all the joints that are involved. So move. Jumping jacks are kind of fun, too. So it's a very good way to warm up.
Sometimes people flap their arms around. I can't do that. I have to be very structured with my arms or my shoulder gets wicky-wacky.
It should be. You should keep the motions very controlled. You don't want to just, you know, throw your arms around, because then what you're doing is you're going past the range of motion of the joints. Keep the movements controlled. Do a really careful jumping jack. Do 10 of them. You will warm up your entire body. You will be much more prepared for more exertion after that. And as I said, it can be kind of fun.
Gosh, it's like good old Jack LaLanne, jumping jacks.
You know, he was, in fact, ahead of his time. And we may not want to dress the way Jack LaLanne did, but he actually, he was still, you know, pulling tractors when he was 80. We should all be in so fit.
He's doing something right. Gretchen Reynolds, it was great having you back again. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Gretchen Reynolds, columnist for the New York Times Well blog, and also her new ebook is out. It's called The First 20 Minutes Personal Trainer, The Right and the Wrong Workouts for Everyone. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.